Welcome to Everyone Loves Guitar, where we sit down and talk with interesting professional guitar players, uncover their stories, and discover what makes them tick. If you love guitar, music, and the backstory of people's lives, stick around. You're in the right place. If you're enjoying this show and you'd like to support it, go to everyonelovesguitar.com/support. And for information on advertising, visit everyonelovesguitar.com/advertise. Are you looking to buy or sell a home in the Tampa Bay area without having to deal with pushy realtors? Then make sure you connect with West Florida Real Estate. West Florida Real Estate has helped over 300 homeowners and investors buy and sell their properties over the last 5 years. Their service is outstanding, just like back in the days when there was actually service in the service business, and you'll never have to deal with any kind of sales junk when you're working with them. For more information, email Ann with an E at westfloridarealestate.com. That's A-N-N-E at westfloridarealestate.com. Hey, everybody, this is Craig Garber with Everyone Loves Guitar. I'm here with an amazingly talented guitarist, really unique, and he is one of the funniest guitar players as well. We're with Corey Wong. He's the guitar player, one of the guitar players in Wolfpack. I love that name of your band. It's like, I love saying it, Wolfpack. I feel like empowered for some reason. And he's also a solo artist, super talented guy. He's out of Minneapolis, and he's put in his time as a versatile composer, arranger, producer, and collaborator, working on shows like NBC's The Voice, playing alongside Ben Rector, Gene Simmons, Questlove, The Blind Boys of Alabama, Bootsy Collins, Blake Shelton, and most recently joining the fast-rising funk band, as I said, Wolfpack, as a touring and session guitarist. Dubbed the most famous Minnesota musician you've probably never heard of, although I don't think that's true, by Minneapolis is The Current, Corey Wong is finally preparing to jump into the spotlight with his new album, Corey Wong and the Green Screen Band. Now, that's been released already, correct?
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
And I guess maybe with that, you could even just leave it out after the Wolfpack thing.
Okay. Let me do that. As a touring and session guitarist. And I'm going to leave that whole section out. Touring and session guitarist, we'll leave that whole section out. And then this new release, blah, blah, blah. So the rest of it is all about the album, though.
Yeah, that's just an old bio.
As a touring, so why don't I just stop it?
Sure.
Wolfpack as a touring and session guitarist. And I'll just say, and you've got three albums now, or two albums and another one coming out?
Yep.
Okay. Corey also has two solo records and a third one coming out that we'll talk about today. And man, I really appreciate your time. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Yeah, man. Thanks for having me.
I didn't get to see the actual Kickstarter campaign you had for your second record, Corey Wong and the Green Screen Band, but I saw like a hilarious promo video for it, and I'm a marketing guy, like, so I want to know, for marketing and musical reasons both, what is the deal behind the I need to raise $100 to buy pizza for my band campaign? I keep thinking it's like some hot lead generation technique I need to know about. What? That was hilarious, man.
I don't know what kind of technique it is, other than I didn't need to raise money to make the record, which is what a lot of those pledge music Kickstarter things are. I guess I was just kind of doing it as a pre-order. And I figured I would do it on a platform that I knew I was comfortable with and that I've used Kickstarter before, and for other people to, that they might be familiar with, to pledge for my record. And it was just one of those things where it was like, I've pledged to a lot of albums and people creating their album, but I didn't want to ask people to help me make my record because I had already made it and I would have felt like it was lying.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to do a fun party for all the guys that played in the band. Cause with that record, the original intention was just doing a bunch of different recording sessions and just kind of seeing what happened. And then what ended up happening is over the course of the year, just kind of coming on and off of tour, just doing a bunch of recording sessions and then ending up with a lot of tunes that I was really happy with. And it was like, these all fit together. And I did all of these sessions in front of a green screen. I'm going to just call the record the Green Screen Band or whatever. And it's, I mean, it's just a bunch of different musicians, because I think I maybe have four or five drummers on the record and four bass players and five or six keyboard players, something like that, something crazy, which I don't normally do. And most bands don't maybe normally do with using that many different musicians. So, and even a lot of those musicians had never even met each other. So I wanted to throw this pizza party, a hang where we do all the songs from the record and then some, and then we just kind of hang and party and people can come meet the band and that sort of thing. So I thought it was just a fun way of promoting the record and, just having a good time with it.
So did you have your pizza party?
I did have my pizza party. It was a blast. We did it in Minneapolis and played the whole record. It was a really fun time. It was great.
With five, six drummers and three, four keyboardists all together.
Only two drummers on that one. But it was great. It was a full band. It was awesome.
That's really cool. So this is like, that's a really smart idea. That's like you're promoting to an audience that has already proven to support you. That's really, yeah, I think it's very smart.
Thanks, man. It was fun. And more than anything for me, it was just a platform that I was comfortable with.
Yeah.
And it's the first time that I was really kind of putting myself out there as, well,
so, a solo artist.
Yeah. In a semi-official way. Like my first EP, I just kind of put up online.
Right.
And just said, hey guys, I have a record out. Check it out. And this way I was kind of making a little more of a grand entrance. And also with that, not having to set a number of, I'm trying to get $15,000 for my record. And then if I don't make that goal, you know, my ego can't handle that.
Well, right? it's not, if you don't get your goal, you're not you're quote, not successful, and it doesn't feel good. And like other people don't support things because they're quote, not successful. So yeah, I totally get that. It was really smart. How did you feel about, like a lot of musicians are super uncomfortable about promoting themselves. How did you feel about it? Because you seem like you felt very natural about it.
I have found myself more and more comfortable doing it when I recognize, look, the people that are paying attention, it seems to be the ones that want to pay attention. And if somebody's not interested in what I'm doing, they'll unfollow me. And that's fine.
Yeah.
And the stuff probably won't hit them. And if my stuff's not connecting with somebody, that's totally cool. I don't connect with a lot of music that other people really like.
Right.
And we all have different preferences. Totally cool. I have learned to live in that mindset. But then also, I try to do it in a way that doesn't feel too serious. I don't ever really take myself too seriously, especially with my music and my marketing. It's just like, I'm here to have a good time, have some joy, spread some joy, and have a great time with my friends. And I hope that it comes across that way in the way that I quote unquote push or market or advertise my music, whatever it is. I just try not to take myself too seriously. And in that case, it's almost as if I'm taking on my stage persona rather than me.
Yeah.
And I've had to realize that I need to separate who I am as a person from who I am as an artist. Just because somebody doesn't like my music doesn't mean that they don't like me.
Doesn't mean it doesn't
or
matter if they,
who
yeah,
I am as a person. Right. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Fucking, like, yeah.
Yeah. So there's all this inner conversation and turmoil that artists can go through. But as soon as I found a way to recognize the difference between myself as an artist and who I am as a person, it's great. It's totally awesome. And I just have to kind of feel and put on that persona, which is just me, amplified 10%.
Sure.
You know?
Sure. Well, I think one of the first things I told you when we started talking was that, without even mentioning any of this stuff, is the way you come across is so cool and so energetic and so positive. So I think that all of those things are accomplished that you said you want to do. Plus, it's interesting, any entrepreneur has this You know, I remember when I first got into one of my sales positions when I worked for a company years ago, I was making like 400 phone calls a week, cold calls, and I was like not doing well and I felt like shit. And I wound up putting this big sign up in my office that said who you are. And then it was a like a slash and said, what you do is exactly what you said. I wanted to make sure I separated because I'm going home to two kids at that time at night feeling like shit every day. And I'm like, well, that's just what I do. Now this is who I am. And I had to keep reminding myself of that because it was, you know, when things are going good, you know how it is. It's good. When things are going bad, it's not so good. You know, so I totally relate to that, man.
Yeah.
What gave you the idea to make like a hand-in-hand video production along with the audio tracks? Is that's your videos are phenomenal. That's a lot of work, man.
Well, thank you for digging the videos.
They're great.
I have a great time doing it. And actually, what I've found is people are just connecting a lot more with videos in general rather than just like going. I mean, obviously, if somebody's going to YouTube, they're going to enjoy the engagement of watching something and listening to it rather than just listening to something with a picture. And I wanted, even when I started making my last record, wanted to figure out a way to just do my own music videos. I was always into like the public access green screen looking stuff. I always thought it was kind of funny and kitschy. I wanted to figure out how to do it myself. So I just figured it out. And what it ended up being was this really interesting and fun creative outlet for me where I felt way less pressure. And it's funny because like I have declared myself to the government as a professional guitar player and I have a music degree in guitar performance. And there's all this stuff where it's like, I am expected to be good at guitar. I'm expected that me as a musician, I'm supposed to be good. Because of all these different things or whatever. People know me as a guitar player, but they don't know me or care about me. And I never went to school or have declared to the government that I'm a videographer or a video editor. So it was a way for me to get like these creative ideas, this creative outlet to happen without any of the inner or outer pressure of you need to be good at making videos. Because it's just like, I don't know, this is just for me, a funnel to get people to listen to my music, and hopefully it's a little bit engaging. And they can, the videos also are just to maybe show a little bit more of who I am in my personality that you might not get just listening to my music.
Sure.
Or something. So yeah, it's been fun to do.
So you're probably a lot more forgiving with yourself in these, in your own expectations, not that they're low, but your bar is probably a lot more forgiving and like fun as opposed to professional. So you can enjoy it more, I would imagine too.
I enjoy it in a different way. It's not necessarily that I enjoy it more. I just enjoy it in a totally different way where there is a complete freedom from like, oh yeah, I know that looks kind of weird, but I don't really care.
Yeah.
I'm not a video guy, quote unquote. So it's fine if I let it go, but really I could figure it out.
Yeah.
You know, like if I hear a little weird noise in my guitar part, or if I'm tracking something, it's like, ah, I'm playing a little ahead or ah, I'm playing a little behind. I know exactly what it is. Just let me redo it and I'll boom, just lock it in. And it's just a different sort of thing. And it's fun on the guitar because I just know, I always know if I'm ahead or behind when I listen back. And I always know how something feels to me or how I feel like a guitar part is interacting with the rest of what's happening. I feel it and hear it in a specific way where I have all this background experience for me, in my opinion, how to adjust things to make it quote unquote work or quote unquote fix it. I always have to say quote unquote as a disclaimer because obviously art is a subjective thing and you know whatever the right guitar part is could be all over the map.
Sure.
But anyways, yeah.
Very cool, man. What were some of the lessons that you learned making your first record and what did you do differently? Let's say the second record really, because the first was an EP, but between the second one and the one that's coming out soon, real soon, what were the things that you learned and what did you do different second time around?
What I learned to do was just manage files, time, and creative output a little bit better, maybe more efficiently. And again, I want to give that a disclaimer because whatever. I'm just going to stop with the disclaimers.
Yeah. No quotes and no disclaimers. You're
no
all
more
good.
No quotes or disclaimers. Everything I'm saying.
It's another
I
burden.
I might change my mind a month from now. So that's right. don't hold it against me. Whatever. Instead of just like cutting one song in front of. So it was very hard to set up sessions for the green screen record because I had to have big studios. And I don't necessarily love recording in big studios. I like it to feel a little more intimate. So with that record, I had to do, it was a blast. It was amazing. I had a great time doing it. But all the studios were big because one huge green screen setup for the drummer to set up on and then mic the drums. So it's doing audio and video all at once. Everything is being watched and recorded live. And that was very hard to do. And I don't necessarily know that the video paid off in the same way that a video of just iPhone camera in studio gives the same sort of thing. Because you're still hearing just the live performance, but you're seeing it in a different way where you feel like you're there. So one thing I've learned is that a lot of people just thought that we were miming on the green screens over what was pre-recorded, which would be way too hard for me to do. But especially like lining up drums and getting the drummers to play the same thing every time, not a chance.
Yeah.
But I just figured out a way, okay, instead of having to get this huge studio for all this video stuff to happen, I'm just going to do it in small studios that I'm comfortable recording in. We can all be kind of close to each other because that's how I like to play and record. And just have one friend filming with his iPhone, the videos, and then all the overdub sessions I'll do as green screens because that's all very manageable and easier to do because I don't have to set up 8 green screens and lights and blah, blah, blah. So like the vocals and the horns and some of the all the different overdubs that we did were all on green screen for this new record. And it made video editing and just the whole recording process way easier.
That's good.
Yeah. Because I like to do videos with all my songs. So
that's amazing that you make a video with every song. It's really like awesome, tremendous effort.
Thank you.
Flip side of that question, was there anything pleasantly surprising about the first go round? Let's scrap the video stuff because that clearly wasn't anything easy about that.
But
just the recording process, anything come out easier or, you know, than expected, or your expectations were, oh, this is going to be difficult and it wasn't?
Yeah. What I realized, and I mean, I should have known this and I think I did in the back of my mind, but I didn't realize how easy it was. The guys that I was playing with are musicians that I've played with for a long time. In previous situations and other things that I've done, I've recorded with guys that I either haven't really recorded with much or haven't toured with, that sort of thing. With these, this record, the last green screen record, and this record that, the Optimist record that's coming out, that's on pre-order now, I've played so much with these guys. I put together demos for all the songs. And what I was so pleasantly surprised with is how easy it just came together. Because I think the more I played with these guys, the more they learned my instincts and the more they learned what I hear and what I like, how I feel a groove, where I feel the time. And I trusted them with that sort of thing. And then it was just a lot of really great collaborative effort as far as specifics on parts. So it was the fun, pleasant surprise was with the musicians that I was playing with. They just made it so easy to do. Like each of these sessions I did for this new record, I did 4 days of tracking and I recorded 24 songs. It's insane.
That's a lot. Holy crap.
And it was really hard to whittle it down to.
So you're going to have 24 tracks on your new record?
No, I'm having 8 on the physical and 7 copies for what'll be on digital distribution. So the eighth tune is kind of like a bonus track that'll be
for getting the physical vinyl. Yeah, that's really cool.
Yep. And there's six other tunes that I'm super stoked about that I just didn't get around to finishing the arrangement on top of what the main meat of the song is. There's a couple singers I wanted to collaborate with that just the timing didn't work out for this year's release. So a lot of the songs I will put out on a future record. A few of them I ended up using for some other artists that I was producing, kind of like, hey, this song didn't really fit on my record, but it's a really cool song. Would you want to use it on your record?
And that's great.
Yeah. So I was producing, I've been producing some different artists, and some of those songs and recordings ended up working great for their projects.
Man, that's fantastic. And now you probably got another album's worth of material in the bank if you want it.
I totally do.
That's really a good feeling, man.
Yeah, it's nice.
Yeah, good for you.
And it's nice to be able to actually like, all right, let's give it the real shootout. What are the best, what do I feel like the best collection of songs is here? And if I share that Dropbox folder with all my friends, what do they vote? Instead of them telling me, what songs don't you like? Because I don't... Your friends can be say some things that you regret hearing them say. So I ask them, pick your four or five favorite songs. And then I just make a spreadsheet.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, well, this one, you know what? Everybody said this one is in their top five. It must be that.
Yeah.
You know, it must be the best one or whatever.
How many guys do you do that with, ballpark?
10 people.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah. It's kind of an inner circle of friends. Yeah. Sometimes it's guys that played on the record, but it's a funny thing. Like, you know, two different bass players are playing on the record. If I send the collections of songs to the bass player, the top five songs happen to always be the ones that he played on.
Oddly enough, weird.
So it's hard to trust people sometimes. Like, hey man, you know, what do you think of this? Man, the keyboards sound great on this song. Oh, yeah, the one that you played keyboards on? Of course you said that. You know?
So you got to like find, you know, 10 of your most ardent fans and send it to them and let that go. That would be a more objective opinion. But then even though they're your fans, it's hard to say. It's hard to do all this stuff. And,
totally.
You know, it's just litmus test. You know, it's nothing statistically, you know, you're going to, you know, rely on as 100% gospel.
Yeah. And it's nice to just have like a general non-musician input too. It's like, hey, dad, I mean, my dad's a huge music fan. My dad's been a music nerd his whole life, but he's not a musician. She's like, dad, what do you like best? He's like, wow, that one was really fun. That one was like, wow, that one was so cool. It's like, okay. He responded to that song in a certain way. That's the kind of response that I'm looking for.
Yeah, so, absolutely.
And then somewhere it's like, yeah, you know what? I don't know why that song's kind of slow, but there's just something kind of oddly and hilariously epic about that song. It's great. It's like, okay, cool. That's exactly what I was going for on this. So it's fun to be able to hear what might be translating to a non-musician or somebody who doesn't think that they know a lot about music. But, you know, people listen to music every day. So I think even non-musician their feedback is nice to have. It's a different perspective.
Well, it must be nice too when someone gives you feedback that, like you just said, I didn't know why I liked it, but there was something about it. And when you say that's what I was going for, that's like really good validation.
Yeah.
That what you wanted to communicate was heard.
Totally.
Yeah, that's great.
And it's beyond just like, wow, I love the snare tone on that tune.
Yeah, you know, yeah.
It's specific. Okay, you're a musician or you're a studio. Like,
yeah.
You know, it's different. Yeah.
That's great, man. You've been involved in so many cool projects with some really cool players, like we talked about earlier, Fearless Flyers with Mark Letieri. And if anybody hasn't heard that, go look on YouTube for Fearless Flyers. It's got Corey and Mark Letieri, who I interviewed in episode 219 of this show, playing with Wolfpack and other cool projects. And I think to be a musician today, not only is this fun, but it's kind of a necessity to some extent to be successful. I mean, you got to go out there and you got to get like spread yourself around. And I was curious what's on the horizon for you moving forward over the next year or so, if you even have something like that worked out that long.
Yeah. So I and I'm just having a blast. Just the time of my life doing the stuff with Wolfpack, doing my solo records right now, and doing some playing on of my stuff. It's different friends of mine that I'm been just tracking. There's a friend of mine in Germany named Marty Fisher, who actually, oddly enough, I met him through my Kickstarter. He pledged to have me record on one of his songs. He sent me these three songs. He's like, yeah, whatever one you think is the coolest or that you think you could really add to. I listened to him, I was like, dude, these songs are sick. I like them all.
Yeah.
He's like, well, what if I just have you record on all of them? I'm like, yeah, of course. And after that, we just started becoming friends, talking more and more over the internet and like over Skype. And I was playing on, I ended up playing on his entire record from my basement.
<that's> He's really in Berlin. Cool.
And he sent me these tracks, and he's just this awesome, hilarious. He reminds me of a German version of me. I don't know how to describe it. Like, he's a multi-instrumentalist guy, fun, creative person, just loves having fun, joyful person, just on the other side of the world. I think he and I, our personalities are very much alike, so we connected. And oddly enough, then I asked him to play on my record. So he's on a couple tunes for my upcoming album, which is so funny. It's so great. So
that's really cool, man, to have that sort of a connection. And then, you know, you give musically to each other. That's really nice.
Yeah, it's great. And my last tour that I did, we did a show in Berlin, and he ended up playing the show with me, with my band. And
oh, so you got to meet in person. That's really
cool. Yeah, we finally met in person, and then we did some more recording together for a few days. It was a blast. And I've just been doing some collaboration with him, which has been a fun other thing. And I don't know. The Fearless Flyers thing has been fun. Hopefully at some point we'll maybe do some live shows.
Oh, that'd be
great. We've had a ton of people ask about them, but we're just going to, I think, just do it when the time is right and when it works for everybody and when it feels like it's the right thing to do. And
well, you guys are all really super busy as well.
Yeah. Yeah. And we've been talking about some other projects similar to that we might be doing. So, yeah, I mean, it's fun to do other projects. Is it necessary to do other projects? Kind of, in a way where I need to, you know, keep my chops up, keep busy, keep myself musically on it. Like, if I was just playing 20 gigs a year with Wolfpack and not doing other stuff, I might lose some of my stage skill, energy, that kind of stuff. But also, I really feel like creativity brings out creativity.
Totally.
And the more I'm being creative, the more creative I become and the more creative ideas come to me. So I feel like it really is in my best interest to play on other people's projects that will inspire me and that I can draw something out of somebody else. And for the same thing, for like my relationship with Marty has been just a fun friendship where he hired me to play on his record. I was inspired by his song, so it was so easy to record on them. And he was just flipping out over the tracks I gave him. And it ended up doing the whole record with him. And then I was just like, wow, how do you get those awesome synth tones? He's just like, oh yeah, I'm doing it and blah, 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 and this and this. I'm like, well, I want that synth tone on this song of mine. Here, how about I send you this? And you know, it's just like this fun, creative collaboration that really just kind of keeps me excited about music and excited about creating that. Yeah, it does feel like it's necessary in that sense for me. You know?
Dude. Well, yeah, you don't get better playing alone. You get better playing with others. And the more different people you play with, the better you get creatively and technically, you know?
100%.
You're originally from Minneapolis. What was growing up there like?
Minneapolis is great. It is cold. The rumors are true.
The rumors are true.
I'm a little bit dark on it right now just because, I don't know. I'm less and less able to handle the cold, but whatever. Insignificant thing to actually complain about.
Not really, man. It's really like cold. It's not, I mean, it sucks. It's not just the cold. It's like, it makes everything difficult. You know, I used to live in New York City. Believe me, I know. I'm not in love with everything that Florida has to offer, but I love the sunshine.
Yeah.
It just makes life easier.
Minneapolis has a really cool art scene. Yeah. It has a lot of great music for a lot of different genres as well. When a lot of my friends from Nashville ask about the scene or New York or LA, like those are kind of your three main industry towns, you know, yeah. music towns that people would consider when they first, you know, what are the top three music towns in the United States? Those would be the three. But whenever I compare Minneapolis, I like to say, and I do say, I would just like to say, I do say that Minneapolis has a really cool art scene that is driven by the art and not necessarily by the industry. And that is its biggest strength and in some cases its biggest curse. As opposed to an industry like in Nashville or like a scene in Nashville, there's just so many people trying to make it. There's so many people that are reaching for that thing. Everybody's trying to, you know, whatever. They're making their art and they're doing that, but there's a lot of people around them suggesting certain things or saying certain things. Oh yeah, man, we want to get this cut on this record. So we got to, let's do this sort of thing for this song rather than this, then where we were going musically, let's go here. So it's more blah, blah, blah for radio.
Well, I think the commercial aspect of what you're saying, if I understand you right, is the commercial aspect weighs heavier on you potentially than it does in Minneapolis.
Sure. And I don't at all mean that there's not really great art music coming out of Nashville and there's really great commercial art music that's coming out. I love the new Casey Musgraves record. My friend Ben Rector, who I've been touring with for a long time, has a really great record that is coming out this month. And I think it's just incredible songs and just done really well. And there's a lot of really great music that's coming out of there. But in Minneapolis, there isn't any of that pressure. I mean, obviously people want to reach a large audience with their music.
People
want to
eat. Yeah.
Yeah. But there's just, it's so much more of a, from what I've noticed in some of the circles that I'm running in, it's more about what are we trying to say artistically with our music and what are we trying to put forward with that all the way. And that is, again, its blessing and its curse because sometimes it does, there isn't like the national mentality of it. You know, a lot of times it's like, oh, that's really cool. You're a local band, you know, and it's weird to have that thought. Yeah. It's just like there's certain things and there's certain ways that people will treat their shows or treat their records where it's just like, oh, you guys are really putting forward that you're a local act and not trying to like dress for the job that you want rather than the job you have or whatever. I don't know.
Yeah. I think that's really weird. I think you're probably right. You're right. I don't know why. Cause that happens. I think in towns like Athens, similarly, Austin, you know, a lot of these places with local scenes that are really strong like that. I think that's probably a common thing. Really weird why that happens. I don't know.
Yeah.
Any brothers or sisters, and did any of them play music?
I have an older brother who is a hockey video game guy, really good at those, would be a really great musician if he would have just chose that as his thing, but he loves hockey, plays hockey still, and older brother. And then I have also three step siblings that came into my life when I was late elementary school, but became my actual step siblings late in high school. So my parents split up, whatever, when I was like six. Dad started dating another woman a few years later. They didn't end up getting married until like 7 years after that or something, though. So my step siblings have been around most of my life. They are my siblings, and which I would be the exact middle of five in that order.
Right.
So my blood brother, whatever, is the oldest. Stepsister older than me. She, basketball player, built to play basketball and sports. I'm the musician. Sister underneath me is a singer, lives in Chicago, and a fun, creative person. And my youngest brother was a sax player, lives in San Fran. Would still be a good sax player if he stuck with it, but Now he's like doing bike tours and stuff in different cities. It's cool.
Man, I've seen
sounds those, like a fun thing.
Yeah, those guys are popping up everywhere. I keep reading about that. You know, walking tours and bike tours. You know, as these cities get more and more crowded, it's like really common. What kind of work did your folks do?
My dad was an IBMer. He retired a couple years ago, but worked sales in IBM. My mom worked, she works at a hair salon as a receptionist. My stepmom worked for 3M as a project manager.
They're headquartered in Minneapolis, correct?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
Isn't it,
my tendency, my, something inside me is like, no, they're based out of Maplewood. It's like, nobody knows where Maplewood is. Yeah, it's Minneapolis. It's
Minnesota Mining and Manufacturing. Is that what that stands for?
Yes. Yeah.
I was this is really weird. I was an auditor. I was a CPA at a school, and I was auditing this company called 4M.
Okay.
In upstate New York, not really far upstate. And I used to tell everybody that, oh yeah, I'm auditing 4M. I'm like, oh man, can you get some of those yellow stickies? And I'm like, you know, because 3M makes the little, you know, sticky pad. I'm like, what the heck?
Anyway. 4M makes them just a little bit bigger.
Yeah, I was like, they're a corrugated cardboard company. I don't even know why I remembered that. I haven't thought of that in like long enough that I'm going to stick it back there. That'll be the last time I think of it again. So when did you start getting into guitar, and how did that whole thing come about? And did you know, like, as soon as you started playing, okay, I'm set forever. This is my, what I want to do, my gift and my journey.
Sure. Oddly enough, I started wanting to be a bass player, and I love playing the bass. I did some piano lessons. It was fun. I started playing piano when I was like 9, did a couple years of lessons. It was cool. Glad I had a little bit of foundation there, but I didn't really connect to it in the same way that I did with the guitar. Played clarinet in the middle school band. But I really wanted to be a bass player. Started playing bass, was just obsessed with the Chili Peppers, Primus, you know, go figure, kid in the 90s playing bass.
Imagine that. Yeah.
Yeah. And then it was like, man, I want to start a band. And the two other friends of mine that were available to, like, interested in, like, yeah, I'll do it. One of them, his dad had a drum set. The other one, his dad had a bass. So they just didn't know how to play any instruments. So what I did is I just kind of figured out, learned how to play drums after school, watched videos, learned how to play drums on my hands, some of the on my legs, coordination, played after school, before school in the band room, taught one of my friends how to play drums. Then it was just like, all right, one guy plays drums, I'm playing bass, my other buddy, his dad has a bass. We can't just be two bass players and a drummer. That was my limiting belief at the moment.
I was going to say,
you actually made a very, very amazing project if that was. Dang it. Well, I missed out. Oh,
man.
So this is seventh grade. So here we are in seventh grade. And there was some of my other friends were all musicians, but they already had a ska band. And I couldn't take any of those guys away because they were like in their ska band. And I so badly wanted to have a band like theirs. But I didn't want it to be the same. We were going to be a trio. So what I ended up doing is worked up enough, begged enough, ended up getting a blue Stratocaster, dark blue Stratocaster. And
love that guitar.
Started playing guitar so I could learn guitar and teach my friend how to play bass because his dad had a bass. And now we could finally be a band. So
God, that is a ton of commitment there, man. Holy crap. That's awesome.
And that was, I set my mind to it. I was going to start a band. Green Day was my formula. We're going to be a three piece. We can make this thing happen. I just need I just need two other guys, you know? And we ended up playing every weekend in my friend's basement, writing songs, playing Green Day songs, trying to play Metallica songs as a three-piece, as a bunch of seventh graders who couldn't play fast enough or whatever. It was just a blast. And that's what really got me hooked. It wasn't necessarily like getting into the craft of it. It was just like, I want to start a band and have fun doing this with my friends and be in a band. And that was such a fun idea for me that that's what got me hooked. And then finally I was like, all right, I need to get some lessons too. I'm running into some issues. Because at this point...
I'm running into some issues. I like that. So at this, you had swung over to guitar at that point. You're like, you know, I like this better. Funny enough.
Yeah. And it just, it was making sense. It was fun. And like, I found out that I was good at it, whatever.
Yeah.
And I worked at it. I practiced, and, at school, we were about to do a presentation, in social studies, we were going to go into this thing about the 1960s and Woodstock and all this. We're talking about it at conferences, and my dad says, oh, Corey just learned how to play guitar. Why don't you have him come in and play, have him do the Hendrix version of the Star Spangled Banner for the classroom? I'm like, Dad, I just started guitar.
How about lesson?
Yeah. So there it is. It's like, boom, trial by fire, you know, test number one. And apparently that's kind of the way that works best for me. And I spent the next 2 weeks learning how to play it. And it was just like, all right, I have to do it. I'm going to be playing in front of my entire class. So I can't embarrass
it
myself.
Off.
Yeah.
Good for you, man.
It'd be hilarious to find a video of it out there. I doubt it is, but
if anybody has a video of Corey Wong playing the Star Spangled Banner Hendrix version in seventh grade, please send it to me.
I would, oh man, that would be hilarious to watch. Because I thought, oh dude, I crushed it. My friends were coming up high-fiving me afterwards. It was just like, all right, this is it, man. I'm in. I'm hooked.
Yeah, but you probably did crush it if you got all that kind of feedback, you know?
Well, I mean, yeah, you never know. When it's your homeboys, when it's your bros coming up to you like, sack, oh, bro, you crushed it. It's like, well, it's, you know, it's a little bit different than some guys are like, you know what? I didn't think you were gonna pull it off, but you did.
Yeah.
Then maybe, but yeah.
You had to do a pretty good job.
We'll say that I crushed it. Yeah.
That's awesome, man. And that's the guitar you still have now.
Well, it's very similar. A few years later, I still have that guitar.
Okay,
it's over in the other room.
I love that thing, man.
So this is my punk rock Stratocaster.
Okay, and then the other one, okay, so it is different. The new one you have is like a pearlized.
That one's just sitting next to my desk.
One I really like. Is that relic'd or did you beat that up?
Well, it's just from high school. Once I got into, I was still a little bit of a punk rocker, even though we were more of a jam band. I bashed the guitar into some cymbals. You know, we would do some stage antics.
I love that guitar, man. This one I've never seen. Looks very cool. It looks like you made it a bicycle there with all the reflectors.
I was dedicated to the craft of trying to be Billy Joe Armstrong.
You certainly were, man. E for effort, for sure. And they both have rosewood fretboards, huh?
Yep.
Yeah, I like playing with rosewood.
And actually, I did end up getting one of the things that I loved about my Strat that I play now. It's 22 frets. That's like the main difference. I was like, oh, I want to get that high note, but I just can't get it because I have to bend to get it. So my main Strat this is a guitar podcast. We can get as geeky as we want, can't we?
Absolutely. Totally.
It's a Highway 1. It's like a 2001 Highway 1 Stratocaster. Nothing special about it other than it just feels like home for me.
That's great.
So I love that guitar. I have loved it since I've played it. I actually have two that are almost identical of that Strat.
Oh.
But it's got Seymour Duncan Antiquity pickups.
Is that the stock pickups they came with, I think?
No, I've tried a bunch of different pickups. Like the Highway 1 stock pickups, I don't know what they are. I mean, they're fine. They're good. I would totally use them. But I went on a tone journey of Texas Specials, too noisy. Lace sensors, didn't like the sound. Fralins or whatever, and then like a Jazz Cat pickup, and then a regular, like the mini humbuckers, and then I just ended up landing on these.
Do you do all the work yourself, or do you take it to someone to swap those in and out?
No, I was taking it to somebody, so it wasn't like I was
expensive journey, man.
Yeah, and, oh,
especially with
a guitar that's so cheap.
Well, no, especially when you're like no, those don't work. it's not like you can get a refund on that because they don't. Yeah,
totally.
It's not really fit. Yeah, that sucks.
That's what sucks about pickups.
Yeah.
Gosh, I know.
So that's, is that an American car guitar or a Mexican guitar?
My main Strat is the one that I use now is an American.
Yeah, that's what I thought. So that wasn't really that cheap. Those are, you know.
Well, I think I bought it on Craigslist for like $600.
That's a good deal, man.
And actually, oddly enough, so I told you I have two of them.
Hmm.
I'm on vacation with my family maybe 15 years ago. Get home from vacation, looking on Craigslist for an amp. Because at the time my amp sucked or whatever. I was looking for an amp. I look on there and I see a guitar that looks exactly like mine. It looks exactly like mine. Actually, I have both of them in here.
Yeah, man.
I don't know if my face
had do this.
So
let me just describe Corey's main Strat. It's what do they call that blue? It's
I don't know, midnight blue.
Yeah, that's it. I think
midnight or sapphire.
It's one of those. It's just like a really pretty. It's like a really pretty navy. It's like a bright navy sort of, and he's got a perloid. Is that what they call that? Perloid or pearlized?
I don't know. Perloid, I think.
Yeah, perloid pick guard with a. It looks like a mini humbucker in the bottom. It's a.
That's this one.
Yeah.
Okay, so check this out.
Oh, okay.
This is my main guitar.
Right.
Right. I'm on vacation. I get home and I see this one on Craigslist.
Whoa.
For $300.
Wow. And it's the same guitar.
Like,
wow.
Markings in the same spots.
Is it the guy's, was it the same guy?
No. I mean, this other one.
That's an American Strat for $300.
Somebody stole my Strat.
Yeah.
Somebody stole my freaking Strat. And they're selling it on Craigslist for $300, right? Because nobody's going to be selling an American Strat on Craigslist for $300.
Yeah.
They're out of their mind. I call the guy. I'm like, hey, I'm calling about that Stratocaster. What's the deal? Thinking like, screw it. I'll just show up and buy my guitar back if I have to for $300. Like,
sure.
It's my guitar. He's like, oh, yeah. I'm trying to raise funds for the Twin Cities Marathon. I'm running it next week or something. And I just didn't raise enough money or I don't know, some marathon or something. I just need to get rid of a couple things. I just have $300 left that I need to get to be able to participate in the marathon. Hold the phone. I'm on my way over. I just go buy the thing for $300.
That's amazing. $300 for an American Standard. That's like sick, man. Really cool.
And that is the guitar that I've been touring with for ever.
Yeah, I thought so because I didn't see, because I've looked at your guitars pretty closely and I didn't see that mini humbucker in there.
Yep. So this one, like the high school guitar, the one with the mini humbucker is the one I use like on the Wolfpack record, Beautiful Game. And it's maybe a little bit of a better all around Strat. Most like pop guys, it fits really well. And like most situations in a lot of sessions, that one works really well. This $300 guy, the Craigslist special, is the one with the Duncan Antiquities.
Yeah.
This one works really well for like the Corey Wong sound. I felt like I got it, it was like, oh, it feels like my voice on the instrument. And that's why I've been using that one more.
And you keep that usually on when you're doing a lot of the funk stuff, the chunky, the chucka chucka. You keep that really on the second pickup in a not second pickup switch to second position. Sorry,
I'm not sure what you.
Sorry,
it's all good.
My wife is leaving. She's like blowing me kisses. Sorry,
it's all right.
She's messing me up.
No shame in that. I use what I call fourth position, which is neck middle. Do you call that second or fourth?
Yeah, second. So it's the same thing. Yeah.
The other guitar player in Wolfpack has always called it second position. The rest of us, Jack and I, call it fourth.
Oh, so you're counting from the bottom up. I'm sure you're right and I'm wrong because I'm not.
I have no idea.
I know about guitars and like what I know about cars, I know how to turn the freaking key and play and that's and drive. I know I'm, you know, so I'm sure it's fourth position, but yeah. Okay. So you're getting like the Strat sound there and the noiseless the hum cancellation and pretty good. When you play, I talked about this earlier, the songs you write, the style of music you play is super energetic and it's really refreshing. And I'm saying that because I like it, not because I'm interviewing you. I genuinely like it. It's really, it's funky as hell, man. It's really great. And I hate to pigeonhole it in a genre, but there is a lot of funk and you have a tremendous sense of groove in what you're doing. And even like I saw you do, some lesson online where you're talking about how you just make your finger into like a Gumby or something like that. You didn't say that, but you said, no bones. Or I was like, man, that's a great idea.
Turn my wrist bones into cartilage.
That's turn your, I'm like, were you drawn to funk early on or how did funk develop as this sort of like, leading, the leading genre of your musical, how you play?
Sure. It wasn't always like the forefront of what I've done. And to me, a lot of funk guitar and a lot of that style of strumming and picking for me comes from my acoustic guitar background and my ska background.
Yeah, for sure. Ska. Yeah.
If you listen to like the that old ska stuff is very much like that, or just straight up strummer acoustic guy. Is a lot of the same wrist and right hand technique as what I use for a lot of my funk comping. But again, I grew up in Minneapolis and Prince is everywhere.
Yeah.
So that sound was always just a part of my fiber.
That was very much woven into the fabric of your musical education then.
Yeah. And it was just around everywhere. A lot of the live bands that are playing out, there's a great live funk scene in the Twin Cities. And insane musicians. So I just watched a lot of that stuff. And where I really cut my teeth was at Bunkers. There's this Sunday, Monday night funk thing, funk and R&B thing where like Michael Bland and Sonny Thompson from the New Power Generation, he discovered those guys like there and picked them up to play with him and tour with him. And those guys are back playing it. They play there a lot. And when I was really cutting my teeth, I was starting to play there, learning from those guys, playing with those guys. And part of that was just like, all right, you need to know the entire Earth, Wind & Fire, Ohio Players catalog.
That's like 300 songs. It's probably 150 songs easy.
Something like that. Yeah. And it's like at any moment, it's just like, all right, In the Stone, go. And it's just like, okay, you got to just be on it. You have to know it that well. And so there was a lot of that as far as my just, again, being thrown into the fire. But I was a punk and ska kid at first. I was a jazzer for a while. Got a lot of the vocabulary and like chops from that era of my playing. But the groove-based stuff really just felt at home. Like I love that feel. The Minneapolis time feel is a fun way of feeling the time. And just the groove stuff is just what I started playing a lot more of that people were like, wow, I'm really connecting with the way that you're doing that. And people would say that I had a unique way of doing it and a unique approach to it. So that made it fun also that people were connecting to it and that I felt like I was really able to express who I was through that style of music rather than just trying to be Pat Metheny.
Yeah.
Because that got old fast.
I would say your approach to it is extremely genuine. I'm not saying it's not unique, but me, it's like very pure because you're like your whole body, you get into it. You could tell this is like, okay, I'm freaking home here. I'm where I want to be right now. It's really cool to see that when someone's enthusiastic about what they're doing. It's just, someone told me, I read a book. I've been in sales for 30 years almost, and I read a book early on. It said something like, he who has the most energy wins in a meeting or in a conversation. And they were referring to, you know, obviously trying to close a deal. But I think it's like that in general. I mean, you're bringing energy into that. And it's not a matter of more, you know, do you have more energy than me? But when you're carrying that energy, it always wins, you know, because it's everybody, sure. Everybody wants energy.
Yeah.
You know, so if you're freely giving of it, it's like, holy shit, this is amazing. It's really cool. Yeah.
That's awesome. Yeah. That's cool.
What are some of the obstacles that you've had to overcome along the way in your musical journey? Either business, personal, whatever you feel like sharing.
Yeah.
Musically.
Well, there have been several different ones in different facets of it. The first obstacle was, can I do this? Like, is this a viable option for me in my life?
Interesting, yeah.
When I first, like, everybody who knew me in high school and even in the first couple years of college, it was obvious to most of them, you should be playing music. You're really good at music. You're passionate about it. It's what gives you life. It's what you do that brings life to other people as well. It's encouraging to watch you play. It's encouraging to whatever. So many people saw that. I wasn't sure whether it was a viable option for me. So my first 2 years of school, I went to school for science at the University of Minnesota. It was great. I did well. I figured, well, I should get a science degree and get some sort of science-y job because then I can do that and then play music with my band in the high, you know, on the weekends or whatever. And then eventually was just like, no, you know what? There are plenty of options for making a living. And then I just really took the leap of faith to do it. I switched my major to be a music major and then did that, took a leap of faith in that. That was a really big obstacle for me. Just mentally, my own insecurity of whether I'd be able to make a living as a musician or not.
Sure.
And that's when I was 20 years old. So from that moment, I never looked back. Actually, I was 20. Yeah. I think maybe it was like right around my 21st birthday. I decided, screw this. I'm going to play music. And it took that long for me to actually just say, this is what I'm doing, like to really declare it. And yeah, never looked back. Then the next hurdle was, all right, how do I actually start making a living now that I'm not in school? And fortunately, I had been playing with some other bands. I had been this whole time kind of learning how to produce music. And even with my band in middle school, I had like a Boss BR-8 recorder and was like producing my band's records when I was in eighth grade, you know, and on like, you know, the little drives that you had to get for it. So it was fun, you know, and always been producing and recording and figuring out how to just do it. And I was doing that in college, right out of college, was making some records.
You mean producing? Playing on records.
Yep, playing on some records, but then also producing some records that were kind of generic end cap music for stores like Target or Borders bookstores, like Irish music.
That's really good experience though, man. I mean,
oh yeah, it was amazing. It was great.
That's really good, I think.
Just like work for hire records. You know,
and you know, it's funny, you can make more money doing that than doing a session on someone's record many times.
There is a lot of times, yeah, you can.
Yeah, so I mean, I don't look at that stuff. Like, I think that's all part of the journey, you know? I mean, people
totally
sometimes say that and like, you know, jokingly, and I think it's great. I mean, there's nothing goes to waste in the creative, you know, process. It's all going to serve you somehow.
Yeah. I love those experiences because I really got to cut my teeth as a producer without my name attached to it also. Mm. Because a lot of those records I would look back on and not want anybody to hear them, you know, and that's totally fine. Or yeah. I wouldn't want them to know that it was me.
Yeah.
And, I, you know, was doing a lot of teaching, and then the obstacle was, how do I start doing more of my own music? How do I start touring? starting to get into that scene. And I don't know, there's just been a lot of different things that are growing pains. And right now it's just like, okay, I'm a part of a band. I'm playing with this band that's, you know, now got successful, and I'm doing some of my own music. What's the obstacle that I can overcome right now with getting people interested in my solo music? How do I continue to develop as a guitar player and as a person and keep my family and home life together, and, you know, just feel like I'm really growing as a person as well, you know, and trying to balance the work family thing. That's like my obstacle right now, is how do I not overcommit myself so I don't burn out or lose interest, you know?
Yeah.
There's a lot of really great fun opportunities that get presented where it's like, oh my gosh, that sounds like so much fun. Of course I want to do it.
Yeah,
and it's like, yeah. Oh shoot. Oh, that's going to make that month really tight schedule wise. Like, all right, if I fly from there back here, okay, I can be home for like a few hours, blah, blah, blah. And then I'll fly out. And then it's just like, whoa, what is, like, you know, it can be crazy to think about those things, but it's an extreme blessing, and I have so much gratitude for the opportunities. It's just hard when there's cool stuff happening. I just have a really hard time saying no and trying to figure out what the right ones are to do and what the ones that are going to really help me grow as a person and as a musician, you know.
Which is a great problem to have.
Yes.
But it's still a problem.
It's still an issue. It's not a problem. It's just something that I'm learning to navigate.
You have to figure it out what works for you. But I thought this was really cool because, two things I wanted to say. One is, as an older guy, 54, listening to this, and where you said, it took me till I was 21 to figure this out. I was sitting there saying, man, what a shame that like our society puts that kind of pressure on a 20-year-old or 21-year-old. Because I'm sitting there thinking,
would it have
mattered any shit at all if Corey just like became a scientist and then became a musician? No. Would it have mattered if he dropped out of college and then traveled and then decided to be a musician and then went back to school? No. And it's like, I just think there's a lot of pressure on, you know, this culture to do, and do is only defined by, you know, career stuff.
Sure.
You know, and like we always encourage our kids, you know, travel when you're finished high school. None of them did it. But we were like, you know, don't work, don't go to school, travel, you know, whatever. Because I think, again, me being older, my vantage point is, you know, do fun stuff. You got plenty of time to do all that other stuff. Unless you have like a wife and kids at that young age, or, you know, other people that are depending on you. But the other thing I thought was cool was your obstacles, the ascendancy of them were all, each next obstacle was the new problem that you had, which, because you accomplished the first one, like basically the first obstacle was, do I do this? Like, is this viable? The second one was, how do I do this? Because you decided to do it. The next one was, how do I do this with my stuff? And then the last one, the one you're working on now, is how do I broaden my appeal? Not my appeal. How do I get more people turned on to my stuff?
Sure.
So I thought each one, you know, that showed like, you know, tremendous progress each step of the way. You're not like, you know, like some people like never get past the first problem and they just have multiple versions of, you know, do I do this over a, you know, whether it's music or any stuff, you know, they have multiple versions of the same, well, I can't do it now because this excuse is present. And then, oh, I got rid of this excuse, but now I have this excuse going on. But I thought it was really cool that, you know, you had this progression, which I thought was nice, you know, shows a lot of movement there. Any players that influence your playing that people would be surprised to hear, Corey?
That people would be surprised to hear.
Well, I mean, always, you know, the standard, there's only like a finite group of who's your influences, you know,
and
there's
a finite
group of them.
Yeah, I know. I like that question. I'm just trying to think of who would be a surprise. Like, I have a lot of influences. A lot of people don't know that I've done a lot of like fingerstyle acoustic and classical guitar.
That is interesting.
You could probably see from my nails that I have.
I saw them earlier. I was like, that's interesting. I was hoping that would come out. Yeah, that's interesting.
And I have people make you know, stupid comments on the internet about my nails, but
you're a guitar player.
Yeah, I know. But I think the modern guitar player, it's not very common, not as much as it was even 10 years ago. So Andres Segovia and Christopher Parkening were big influences for me. I actually got to do an orchestra concert, also like playing with Christopher Parkening, which was insane.
Very cool, man.
That was 15 years ago, I think now. And he's just like, you know, he's one of the cats. He's one of the guys. Like, yeah. So those guys are big influences. My teacher, my music teacher, my mentor is a guy named Andres Prado, who's from Lima, Peru, and happened to be teaching in Minnesota for the few years that I was in music school. And he taught me a lot about just music and life and creativity and expression in general, but also taught me a lot of traditional Afro-Peruvian music.
That's very cool.
Which is music from the coast of Peru, a lot of history there. So I studied a lot of the Afro-Peruvian catalog and records and all of that style of music. That was part of my, you know, classical and folk music playing that I loved to do. Hmm. But a lot of people just don't know that side of me. And
yeah, that is interesting.
I haven't shown that side as much in the last few years. Yeah. And then, you know, I guess some people are still also surprised, like, wow, you were really a huge Aquabats fan.
Like, what is Aquabats? I don't know.
The Aquabats is a ska band.
Oh, I didn't know
exactly.
That.
Exactly. Not a lot of, I mean, some yeah, people
never
just
heard
don't
of them.
Know who they are. They were my favorite band, like the Aquabats, Less Than Jake, Real Big Fish. I was such a ska kid. And the drummer, the original, maybe not the original, the first couple Aquabats records that I had, the drummer was a guy who went by the name The Baron Von Tito, who his real name is Travis Barker.
Holy.
After playing, he got the job with Blink.
Wow.
After playing with the Aquabats. And... that's how I got into Blink 182 in high school, was because I was a fan of the Aquabats, which is hilarious. So that surprises a lot of people.
Yeah, that's
I was
interesting.
A ska kid, and that I knew all, you know, so many of those artists, and I was, you know, big into that scene.
Very cool, man.
Like, I was paying attention to every punk and ska record that came out of Gainesville, Florida. When I was in middle school, like, I knew every person.
Is Gainesville like a mecca for punk and ska? I don't even know that.
Like, for, 100 miles this away. Dude, Michael King, what was his? It was Kung Fu Records, I think was the name of it. Hold on.
Well, I know who the other Ed King, I think, lives in Gainesville from Lynyrd Skynyrd. Probably not any relation.
There was like this sax player. I don't know. There was like bands like the Vandals, and there's all this stuff that came out of that record label. They were a California label, but there was like Less Than Jake came from Gainesville, and there was like a lot of crossover in these circles. And I was just huge into all of these different bands, like SoCal ska and punk, and then like Florida.
I didn't know Gainesville had a ska punk scene. That's pretty interesting. The only thing up there is like University of Florida, which obviously is a lot of people, but you know,
yeah,
maybe that influences or carries that.
Yeah. So that it's a funny, different thing that it's a past life. Hence all the stickers on this guitar.
Yeah, like, man.
This is an Aquabat sticker right here. And this is a Less Than Jake sticker and a band called The Hippos. Yeah, I mean, it's funny, man. It's
Aquabat funny. Sounds like that something that would be on that show that my kids watch, and I'm sure you know the name of it. It's like a cartoon with the hamburger.
They're on that show. I think I know what show you're talking about. I don't remember what show.
It's a it's like on. It's like oh my god.
They were on this TV show. Well, they have their own show called the Aquabats Super Show now, but they were on, what was that show that they used to be on?
It sounds exactly like
Yo Gabba Gabba.
No, another one like that though. I can't think of the name of it. It's like in that genre of show.
Okay.
Yeah. Cause it was like the tail end of my kids watched that. Just like they caught the tail end. They were a little too old for that, but Musically, if I asked you to pick your top three Desert Island discs in no particular order and knowing this could change tomorrow, what's like your knee-jerk reaction to what you'd want right now?
Knee-jerk reaction. I like that you gave me the out of being able to change it tomorrow. Weezer, Blue Album, Steely Dan, Asia. What's the third? Just knee-jerk. Why can't I just knee-jerk it?
You're doing so well.
Either, I don't know, like either an Earth, Wind & Fire record or a Prince record. And it's just like, I have this inner turmoil. Every Minneapolis part of me has to say like Controversy or Dirty Mind, Prince. But I don't know. I've been into Earth, Wind & Fire a lot lately. And that's just hard with like the era. What do I choose? I might just have to go with like the 20th Century Masters Essential Earth, Wind & Fire.
I was going to say, pick a box set. You'll be safe, man. What do you like most about yourself? That's kind of a tough question, but.
I like that I am a positive, joyful person.
That you are.
Yeah.
And that's not easy.
Yeah. And I try not to take it for granted. And there's times where I can sometimes go in this place in my head where it's like, I have some friends that have gone through some experiences in their life that have been less than fortunate, or, you know, people, family members around them that have had whatever. Mm. And they've turned from being positive, joyful person to not.
Yeah.
And it's really tough to see. And I sometimes have a little bit of a fear of something like that happening. But I remind myself that, you know, the way that we respond to different situations or adversity or whatever, you know, that is a big part of what makes us who we are. And I feel like if I'm conscious and I have the self-awareness enough that I'll be able to keep positive, joyful mentality and a learning experience from whatever happens, you know?
Yeah. Well, life is tough. It's going to give you a lot of opportunities to become an asshole.
Yeah, it know? Certainly does. Yeah.
So, I thought, you know what? I just noticed, and this is not, I mean, to change the subject, but you have like a Black Beauty Les Paul in there. Wait, screw this.
How did you see that back there?
Screw this self-analysis, Corey. I want to freaking see your. I just saw it. It looks good. It's like, wow. He's got a Black Beauty Les Paul.
This is like a 90s.
It is a beauty.
Standard. I bought from Norm's.
Oh, my God. Did you like, you have to buy something from Norm's when you're out there? Is that like kind of the deal?
There's a lot to buy. It's just whether I can afford it or not. This is like a 60.
That looks beautiful, man. That's a Gibson's.
That's a CS-175.
That's a really pretty guitar. Do you play that a lot?
I don't actually. Oddly enough, actually, I'm selling this guitar. If anybody wants to buy it, email me.
It's a beautiful guitar, man.
Because, oddly enough, my main jazz box that I play is an Eastman.
And you prefer that?
Oddly, yeah. I mean, yeah.
I know a lot of people who have Eastman, and I know a lot of people who have Collings. Like that they like the Collings 335 over the, that Gibson 335 there. So
sure.
It's very believable. It's different strokes for, you know, and every guitar you could play the most amazing guitar that happens to be an Eastman or an ESP or an LP
or
whatever. It's that's just label stuff.
And it's nice that I actually enjoy the Eastman is again, like an, I don't know, $900 guitar or something. Hmm. It the neck shape feels really great. Feels natural in my hand. I love the ES-175 Gibson. The neck is just, the nut width is really thin. So.
Well, you have really long fingers. So that's probably not, you need thicker necks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't like the baseball shape neck, but I like a lot of spacing in the strings.
Yeah. I could see that.
Yeah.
Flip side of that last question, what do you like about yourself? Positive, joyful person. If you could change one thing about yourself, what would it be?
Well, maybe I wish I was taller. I don't know. It's a thing that I can't change.
How tall are you? You're like 5'10", 5'11"?
I am five. Well, I like to say I'm 5'9".
Yeah, I'm 5'9". But you're at least like, you look tall, man. You look like you're taller. I look like I'm 5'9".
I have really long, skinny fingers.
Yeah.
I guess I'm thin.
Yeah,
so
it's awesome.
Maybe that helps.
You'll be watching those. You'll be watching that waistline one day, Corey, and you'll be grateful. Best childhood memory.
Best childhood memory. Probably being in seventh grade, walking home, and my mom saying, "Why don't you go look in your closet?" and seeing this exact
bass guitar,
is that
Fender,
sitting in my closet, and I freaked out.
That's so cool.
Yeah, it's this just made in Mexico jazz bass, off-white. It's the one that I play in, like, if you ever see me playing a white jazz bass in all my videos, I still play that guitar. Oh my gosh, I love it. I can't even, it's like this, it was this rush of, it's all going to happen. It's all finally going to happen.
That's so cool.
It was this crazy, weird feeling, like, go take a look in your closet after school.
Oh, a bass. Cool,
finally, I can do it. Like, I can do it.
I'm on my path.
Yeah.
That's cool.
And then, yeah. Oh, that was funny. And the first book my dad getting me is like the Red Hot Chili Peppers Blood Sugar Sex Magic Bass Tabs book. Again, trial by fire, where it's like, yeah, you know, that stuff's not easy.
No, he's a really,
but it was just like, all right, this is the song, this is the record I love. I'm going to learn these songs.
Well, it could have been worse. It could have got you like, you know, Yes. I mean, not Yes, or Yes, or Rush, or something.
Yeah,
like
there's some Rush tunes. Yeah,
that would have been a problem.
And funny enough, though, a different opposite experience. When I got my first guitar, my first electric guitar, that Strat, I got the Guitar Tabs book for Evil Empire, the record by Rage Against the Machine.
Oh,
and
yeah.
I didn't have any guitar pedals. I'm just going DI into my little crate amp. And I'm listening along and I'm playing. And I'm like, dude, I am playing exactly what this thing says, but it doesn't sound anything like the record. And I'm so pissed because I'm just like, oh, it says hit this pedal and this pedal and this pedal and use the Digitech whammy and press forward and back on this. It's like, I don't have any of that stuff.
Yeah. You know, it's really funny. I read an interview with Tom Morello, like, this is a while back, probably 7 or 8 years ago. And he was saying that something about, I think effects are overrated. And I'm thinking, this guy's like made his whole, and I love his playing, don't get me wrong, but he's like, this is like, you know, a chef saying, you know, spices are overrated. Like, I was like, how do you,
sure.
You wonder that could be those things. So sometimes I when I'm going to interview people, they say, hey, you're not going to make me look bad. I'm like, no, it's audio. Only you can make you look bad here. And we can even edit that out. So it's, you know, and I guess that's the only thing I could imagine. Like somebody like paraphrased him or, you know, made their own interpretation of it.
Sure.
That doesn't sound like something Tom Morello would say at all, ever. Weird. Tell me something.
I love pedals too, man. I mean, it's funny because a lot of people who are familiar with my music now, especially like in the Wolfpack community, I'm just DI guitar guy.
Yeah, I didn't think you use a lot of pedals, to tell you the truth.
No, like I use a compressor pedal when we play live, and one little, you know, thing for like one song. But I'm doing sessions every day where I've got two full pedal boards. I love pedals.
Cool.
Are they overrated? To some people, I think, but
yeah, if you use them, if they're too, it's like saying, is a drill overrated?
Six sounds, yeah.
Not to a carpenter. I mean, you know.
Yeah.
Doesn't make any sense. Tell me something about yourself people would either be surprised to hear or might find a little odd.
I cannot stand watching people chew gum while they're playing on stage. I just realized that a few months ago, was like, you know what? I can't stand it when I'm watching. It's so, I don't know why it's so distracting to me. It's not probably distracting to anybody else. And all my friends are just like, dude, you're out of your mind. But it's just, I don't know what
whatever,
it is.
Whatever,
I don't like watching people chew gum while they're on stage. And maybe it was like my sixth grade band instructor that just really set it home for me, or just said some sort of thing that traumatized me for chewing gum while playing music. But I was watching a video of my friend play bass on his Instagram, and I was like, dude, what are you doing chewing gum? He's like, hold on a minute, man. Hold on a minute. That's
of no, all the no, things. No, no, no. Now you sound like an internet troll. I cannot believe you're chewing gum.
Totally. I sound like one of those YouTube comment jerks. It's just like, your pants suck.
Well, I did an interview one time, and the guy said, Roger Powell, who's a guy who played with Utopia, Todd Rundgren's Utopia. And I thought he was saying Roger Glover. So I said, oh yeah, from Deep Purple. So someone writes a comment. He goes, this interviewer is an idiot. He knows nothing about the history. He knows nothing at all about the history of music. And I never respond to those, but I just said, hey man, I made a mistake. That's all. To tell me I know nothing about the history of music, you have the right to say that, but I think that's a bit of a push, you know? So this always, like, you're never going to make everybody happy, you know?
Yeah. It is what you can it is. Always count on the internet to correct you.
Yes.
And you thank can use that to your advantage, though, sometimes. So I was just about to send the artwork for my record. I was just about to send it to the vinyl manufacturing plant. And I was kind of making a joke, like, well, there was one thing. I said, pick between these, what album cover do you like the most? And really, it was just like the one where it says Corey Wong, The Optimist, all in caps, or Corey Wong in all caps, and then The Optimist, just with the first letter of each of those.
First caps.
Right?
Yeah.
And then there was a joke picture in there that was just like, ha, funny, me in high school in my soccer uniform. And then at the end of it was like, oh, and also here's the back of the record. Tell me if I have any typos. And it was just kind of a way for me to like show people who was going to be playing on the record and how many songs were on it. And just kind of a little bit of a sneak peek. And it was fun. It was definitely to my advantage. It was like, hey, yeah, like you have all caps on side A, but where it says side B, it's not all caps. It's like, oh yeah, you have the apostrophe in the wrong place for this. You have this and this and this. Like, wow. All right. Thank you, internet. This is the first time people are coming at me, correcting me. And I'm totally digging it.
Yeah, yeah.
Saved me from printing, 500 vinyl records with typos.
Very cool. Well, that's a good promo idea. That's a really nice way of promoting something too, without being a dork. It's smart. You're a good marketer, man.
Thanks.
Who's had the biggest influence on your life?
Depends on what facet of my life. If I were just to go with the simple, like, it's a guitar podcast answer, I would say my music mentor, Andres Prado, not just because he was a really great guitar teacher for me, but because he really taught me about self-expression and finding your own voice. Sorry, people can't see, but I'm plugging my nose here because I have a little bit of allergies.
You have allergies in Minneapolis. Come to Florida, man.
Yeah. So Andres really taught me a lot about self-expression through music and finding my voice as a musician and finding my voice on the instrument. And I feel like him constantly drilling that into me paid such huge dividends for my career as a musician, and also for it paid... Him expressing that stuff really paid huge dividends for me in my career in the long run, expressing who I am as a musician, finding my own voice on the instrument, but then also just not trying to mimic other people, but to really find out who I am as a musician helped me discover more about who I am as a person.
That's really
and
cool.
What the deeper message being, what do I want to say with what I'm playing and what I'm doing? And that is, part of the, I'm a fun, joyful, positive person. And that's a big part of my message. And trying to figure out how to use the guitar to get that message across. It's not always easy if there's not lyrics.
No,
right?
It's definitely
so
not easy.
A lot of it has to do with the tone, timbre, notes, progressions, tension and release in the harmonic and melodic movement, rhythmic movement. And then also just in the stage presence of it. You know, there's so much that goes into that that expresses what the message is that I'm trying to get across. So,
well, also in the sincerity.
That's the easiest answer for me to say about my life.
The sincerity of it too, because you can't, you know, your music is very sincere because you can't have all that energy being doing playing something that's insincere, that's not a representation of who you are, you know?
Yeah.
I think that's important. Do you have any non-musical superpowers?
Non-musical superpowers. I can be amazing at trial by fire, and I can be, if I really set my mind to deliver on something, I can do it. And I have an extreme confidence in that. Obviously, there's self-doubt and things of like, oh, I don't want to set, you know, $15,000 for my Kickstarter because I don't know that I'll be able to raise it. Obviously, there's a lot of self-doubt and things like that and insecurities that we have, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
But there are certain times and certain things that will kick into me a certain level of confidence that will allow me to do things where people are like, dude, I have no idea how you pulled that off. For example, being in seventh grade, not knowing how to play anything other than a couple power chords, and then 2 weeks later playing Jimi Hendrix Star Spangled Banner in front of my class. Second example being freshman year math class, first day of class, teacher says, I don't know, he was going on and on about something, and then he was just like spitballing and spewing some thing, and he just basically said, look, I know that nobody in this classroom can do this. So immediately I'm just like, oh, what? He's like, if somebody can come in here tomorrow morning, this is like around a noon class. If somebody can come in tomorrow, so like Monday was a noon class, Tuesday was 8 a.m. Somebody can come in here tomorrow at 8 a.m. and memorize 150 numbers of pi. You don't have to come back to class the rest of the semester. I'll give you an A. Nobody will be able to do it. And I did it. I said 200 numbers of pi.
Nice.
In one day, I memorized 200 numbers of pi because I was so determined.
And you got to skip class for the whole semester, or was that bullshit?
I went twice a week instead of four times a week.
And he gave you an A.
He gave me an A.
Good for you, man.
And just there's just certain things where it's like, if I really put my mind to something, I'm able to channel a certain thing where it's not a superpower. And it's sometimes really hard to get me there. And sometimes the stupidest challenge that will get me to do it. But it is somewhere inside of me to do that. And not just to be motivational speaker guy, but I think most people have that ability. It's just learning how to tap into it. Learning how to tap into, like, getting yourself in a mental state where you can just be firing on more cylinders than you think you've got.
Desire has to be there, though, man. That's
yeah.
the thing. And some people just don't have that fire.
Sure.
You know, sounds like you work well under pressure, which is great.
Or I think everybody has that fire and has desire. They just don't know how to tap into it. I think everybody has fire and desire. It's just, there's a lot of work that might need to take place for them to be able to. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
I don't know.
I sure do.
I really, yeah. It would be hard for me to say that people, certain people just don't have it.
I've met some people that don't have it. And like, you just look and you say, man, that guy's broken. And it's sad, but it happens once in a while. And it's very few and far between, but I have seen that occasionally. And it's sad, you know, where somebody just basically lost all the will to live. And they're just walking around like faking it. Now, not that they're suicidal, but they just, you know, something happened to them, and unless there's a major, major change, nothing's going to change, you know, so, and you have to be like nothing shy of a miracle. And I hate even saying that, but I have seen a few dudes like that, you know, but yeah, sure. But you have to want it. And most people, you know, that want has got to be big enough, you know?
Yeah.
So you mentioned this a few times about balancing things in your family relationship. You have kids or like a single relationship?
Yep. I have been married for 9 years. We got married pretty young.
Dude, congratulations.
Thank you. Two girls that are 7 and 5. The 7-year-old is an artist, visual artist. She has declared that as her thing. It's hilarious and amazing and so encouraging to see.
That's great.
See her like you can be an artist if you put your mind to it. Don't let anybody tell you. Oh my gosh, that's the cutest thing.
That's motivational speaker. And
I know.
And, yeah, man. She'll be running an internet site any day now.
Yeah, I know. My five-year-old, she's into Taekwondo. That's her thing right now.
Really cool.
She's got her yellow belt. It's her first thing that her older sister isn't. It's like her first thing that's hers, you know, that's like not what her older sister also does. So it's fun. It's great.
That's cool,
it's
man.
It's instilled in her a certain amount of confidence. I can just tell she carries herself in a different way. She has a different self-awareness, even just from.
Yeah.
She's still just not just a yellow belt, but she's got her yellow belt. And now it's fun to see.
Yeah that's a real important thing, especially for girls, I think, you know. Man, you're so young to be married, 9 years. Congratulations. That's really amazing. You have any hobbies or interests outside of music?
I still like to skateboard and snowboard.
Awesome.
That's those are
ska, you know, habits.
That's, yeah, I was going to say those are just remnants from the punk and ska days. I got to be careful with it now, obviously, with my livelihood being jeopardized if I fall. That's me knocking on wood.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like to do those things. I like to exercise and eat healthy food. I love coffee. Coffee is a hobby.
That's big in Minneapolis, isn't it? It's a big coffee city, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a nice coffee scene. And
is Peace Coffee there? I buy coffee from a company called Peace Coffee. I feel like that maybe is.
I see it all around, but I don't know that I
if they're there.
I don't know if it's here. I do a coffee subscription from a few different roasters. Well, I do this thing called Misto Box, where they do different small roasters around the country. And every once in a while, I do Madcap Coffee based out of Grand Rapids. I get some of their coffee, Slate Coffee Roasters, Blue Bottle every once in a while, too. Misto or Misto Box, I don't know what it is. They send me one bag of beans every month. And then also, there's like the Minneapolis roasters that are great too. Get stuff there.
Yeah, I'm good coffee. I love good coffee. Can you talk about a specific experience you had that changed your life or altered the way you think about things?
Yes. A big life-changing moment for me. When I was 16 years old, I started having this weird thing where my right arm would go numb, and how do I explain it? It's like it went numb from the bone outward, and it was the weirdest thing. It felt like my bones went numb, and then my muscles were numb, and then my skin was numb. It's like, you know, my friends could do a snake bite on my arm, you know, where they twist your skin, and I just like wouldn't feel it. And they'd be, it's like, you know, these are strong dudes.
Wow.
And I couldn't really use my arm. It was going numb. And, was going to the doctor for it after it was starting to, it was like once a week it was happening. And then it was starting to happen a little more frequently. And then it kind of went away. But in that time I went to a bunch of different doctors and specialists to see what was going on. One of the doctors basically said, it appears as if there's a blood clot in your arm. And what we're looking at is this and this and this. And basically them sitting down, my mother and I, in this, you know, very official looking doctor office where it's like, you know, this guy's not some resident. Like, it's, you know, big, nice chairs that I can't afford, big desk that wouldn't even fit in my office, saying there's a chance that if we don't find this in the next week, you will die. And like just seeing my mom like,
That's not what you want to hear as a parent.
And me just like, whoa, like I just got my license, man. What do you mean? You know, and I'm like, I've got all this life to live. And it was one of those things where I was able to take that experience rather than just being totally bummed about it, being able to really just find the love and joy in the everyday moments that I had. And every day for the rest of that summer was just such a cherished, incredible day, like with my friends and everything I was doing. I was just finding so much joy in the birds in the morning. And I was finding so much pleasure in just going out and looking at the sky and nature, like hanging out with my friends and the sound of my skateboard wheels on the sidewalk. It was just like this interesting thing that I don't know. I haven't even thought about it for a long time. I haven't talked about it in a long time. But what it ended up actually being was, it was from I was in like a jiu-jitsu boxing thing. That's what I did for a long time. Also, when I was in high school, as a sport thing, kind of an accident in there. What ended up happening is I had a TIA, a transient ischemic attack. Yeah, which, because you know what that is, you know what that is. You would only know what that is if you have close experience with it.
Yeah.
Which, to those who don't, it's like a minor stroke.
It's a mini stroke, yeah. But that's not a symptom of it. The four symptoms of, it's not numbness in your arm, really.
It was very weird the way that it manifested, because it was in one side of my brain that was just like, there was something that happened that triggered that response as it was healing. So I don't know what it was. There wasn't other.
So they ruled out that there was no blood clot there.
Correct. And that's, you know, like 3 weeks after they told me I had, you know, potentially a week to live. That's just like, oh yeah, you could just die because this blood clot's going to go in your brain. And, you know,
how did they come up with that it was a TIA?
A bunch of like MRIs, different tests.
They saw it in your heart or in your brain, one of the two.
Something. Yeah, I don't really remember. I mean, it was a sort of thing where I was maybe at the doctor 40 times, a different specialist.
Holy shit, your parents must have been freaking out.
Yeah. Yeah, especially when they say there's a blood clot and you could die.
Yeah, I'd be, you know.
It was not fun.
Yeah.
It sucked. Yeah. But it was one of those things where it's like, you know what? I'm just going to remain positive. I'm going to remain joyful. And hopefully that will be how people remember me. And there was just something so potent about that experience that maybe really helped as a catalyst in that era of my life that I still carry today.
I was going to say, do you think that set the ball in motion for to quote you, positive, joyful person that you are today?
I think so. I mean, it definitely, obviously, as I'm thinking out loud as I'm telling the story and talking about it. But yeah, I mean, I think that's one of the main things that really got me thinking about that sort of thing and the way that we live our lives, the way that we present who we are, the way that we interpret things that we say happen to us or happen for us.
Right.
Happen against us, whatever.
Yeah, I've learned you should substitute four for two. It makes your life a lot less of a victim.
Yeah. And yeah, I mean, that moment, that summer really was a growing experience. And yeah, it was crazy.
Man, thank you for sharing that. That's really deep. Your arm's okay now? You never have any problems with it?
I haven't had a problem since they figured out what it was. They were like, yeah, this is what happened. I don't think you're going to see any. There has not been a single issue since.
So that was just the presentation of how that impacted you for some unknown weird reason.
And what they were saying is that's how it maybe manifested itself in its healing. I don't know if it was like inner scabbing over or scar tissue getting fixed that did something.
Very
I mean,
weird.
Since my brain has been fine since then, like since then I memorized 200 numbers of pi in one night.
There you go.
And have,
so
you know,
there.
Every other song that I've ever learned, every song. Yeah.
Yeah.
All the stuff that I learned in college, everything I do now, every song that I've played has been since then. Every note that you've heard me on record has been since then.
Did you wind up finishing?
A decade since.
Sorry. Yeah. Did you wind up getting your degree?
Yeah. Yeah.
In music.
In guitar performance. Yeah.
At University of Minnesota.
At McNally Smith College of Music in St. Paul.
Cool. Man, I'm going to ask you two more questions, and I really appreciate your time. I've enjoyed this, and you're an awesome dude. Man.
Yeah.
Funniest thing that's ever happened to you on stage or in the studio?
Okay, there have been a lot, especially the last couple of years playing with Wolf. We've had some hilarious, fun things, and that's just kind of how it is. Where it's like, you know, you start playing with some of your best friends, and it's just like such fun, weird stuff happens. But I think what really will always take the cake for me is my first gig ever. And it's my funniest gig story, and it's my first gig story, which I feel glad about that. So I'm in, this is summer after seventh grade.
Wow. So you're like all of 12, 13 maybe?
Something like that. Yeah. The band is drums, bass, I'm on guitar and singing backgrounds. There's another guy singing lead. Okay, so that's a four piece. And then there was just like one of our other friends who was really close to us who could kind of sing. So he was also just kind of hanging out on stage, yelling and doing a little bit. Okay, so there's five of us, right? All seventh graders. First gig ever for the Minnesota State Fair talent contest. Okay, talent show. The guy right before us at the talent show is this musician. This guy who's a magician, okay? Magician goes on stage right before us. We're side stage. They're running a tight ship. There's a stage manager like, all right, magician, you go out there. You do your tricks. Couch Potato. That was my band. Couch Potato, you guys load side stage.
Couch Potato. And what just, a great name.
for a seventh grade punk band.
Awesome, awesome.
Couch Potato, you guys stand side stage, have your guitar and your amp in hand, rolled out as soon as the magician's done. You got to go set up, plug. They're going to put the mics in front of you and you just go. Right? So we're standing side stage and the magician is doing that. So he's this dude. You could tell he's nervous. At the time, I'm in seventh grade, so I have no idea how old he is or the women who are with him, maybe college age-ish. I don't know. He's doing the thing where he puts a girl in the box and has the swords. And there's another girl. So there's two girls and this guy. Swords in the box trick with the girl in there. Okay. Hilarious. I mean, gosh, now that I'm saying it's a hilarious story, it's not. It's the craziest gig story. How about that? It's not my funniest gig story.
That's all good.
Now I'm regretting starting this story with that when it's the funniest gig because it's not funny that this happened. I'm just going to continue though.
Go ahead.
So what happens is guy wheels the girls out. He does some card tricks. Doesn't really pan out because it's this huge state fair crowd, whatever. It's like, all right, yeah, cool card tricks. It's not really translating to a huge audience. Does some other tricks, pulls the rabbit out of the hat, standard stock tricks. Then big finale for his magic show, puts one of the girls in the box. Other girl shuts the lid of the box. He starts whoosh, 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 whoosh. Sharpening the swords. You know where this is going.
Oh my God.
He's sharpening the swords. He's doing his thing, doing the showmanship stuff. Whoosh. First sword goes in just fine. And we're watching side stage like, dang, dude, this guy's pulling off the swords in the box trick. Whoa, he's cutting the girl in half. Seventh graders, right? Then all of a sudden, second sword. You can tell it's like stuck, not going right. And then he's just like, muscles it through. You hear a scream from
inside
the box. And the guy's just like, you know, he's still talking in his mic. You can tell there's some hesitation. We're just looking at each other like, dude. You know, seventh grader's like, dude, what happened? Dude. Third sword goes straight through. Fourth sword. Little bit of trouble again. He starts muscling it through. And this time, by this time, the girl is screaming from inside the box. Oh my and the God. Other girl, you can tell is her friend, is just like, what are you doing? Get her out of here. And the guy's like trying to play it off and he's trying to still like do the trick. And we're just side stage with our jaws on the floor.
Oh my God.
My buddy's, two of my friend's parents are side stage with us, like yelling at the stage manager to get the magician out there. So finally, the other girl like pushes the magician away, pushes the box to the side stage where we're all at. And there's like a little bit of a pool of blood piling up underneath the box next to us, right next to my crate 1-212 amp, you know? And I'm just like, how can we help? The girl is screaming inside the box and there's five of us seventh graders just like freaking out, not knowing what to happen, what to do or what's happening. And the stage manager just goes out on stage, like, ladies and gentlemen, couch potato. And they push us out and we have no idea. Like, this is like screaming bloody murder. Everybody out in the audience like realizes what has just happened. So everybody's like standing up, looking side stage. Ambulance comes barreling down, screaming sirens. We push our amps on stage and we're just facing side stage playing our song, like this punk rock song, watching this girl get pulled out of this box and the ambulance. Like, fortunately, it wasn't like any, like, it didn't go through her liver or anything. It was just like kind of like it got through part of her arm and part of her leg. And that's where it was just like
so lucky, that girl.
Oh yeah, totally. But it was just this insane, like, what is going on? Nobody in the audience is paying attention to us because they're just looking over at the side stage at the state fair at what's happening. As are we, as we're trying to play this song. And there's just like, it's just pandemonium.
Oh my God.
And that was my first experience into
welcome to the music biz, young man.
Yeah, that's the music biz. And it was just such a traumatizing moment for all of us. But at the same time, when I look back on it now, turns out the girl ended up being fine. This is, again, what, 20 years ago now? So it's now it's funny to look back and be like, wow, that was my first gig ever. That is
Well, that's what's funny about it. Yeah, the incident
yes,
funny.
That's
the
we're going to turn this thing around. Yeah. That's what's funny about it.
I'm a marketing guy. Yeah, that's what was funny about it. The whole thing, that being your first gig. Wow, that is creepy as shit. Oh, my God. And the girl was okay, though.
Yes, she was fine, but it was just like this dude was way in over his head, and I don't even know how we played that. Nobody knew how we played because nobody was probably paying attention.
Wow. But hopefully he didn't do any more magic after that.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe he is David Blaine now, though.
in an amazing change of destiny. Wait, David Blaine is from California. Imagine that if.
David Blaine got his start at the Minnesota State Fair performing right before Couch Potato.
Yeah,
was opening for Couch Potato.
Oh my God. Last question, and I really genuinely thank you for sharing everything. This has been really interesting, and thanks for being so transparent and sharing all your stories.
Yeah, man.
Last question: knowing life is precious, and this is actually a question that ties in with everything we just talked about. Knowing life is precious and time is not infinite. What's the one thing that's most important to you to make sure you're doing or using whatever time you have left wisely?
I think it's probably tying together some of the things we've talked about earlier, just as far as what is the message you're trying to share with everything that you do. Like, I actually try to have a pretty acute awareness of that, not just in my music, but in life in general, how I present myself. And just like what's the impact you want to leave for the next generation? What's the impact you want to leave for the next 10 generations as far as, outlook on life, as far as environment, as far as all of that kind of stuff. And I think, you know, it's just figuring out what your priorities are. And, for me, kind of having a guiding light of my faith is an important thing that's helped me keep my priorities in order and to keep me balanced and, like, you know, the main thing, the main purpose, you know, the main, yeah, that sort of thing.
Yeah. A lot of people I've spoke with have the same thing, and, like, really their faith is important to them and helping them through this stuff. So it's a pretty common thing I hear. Mm-hmm. And obviously it's very valuable for people who value it, which is a redundant, stupid thing to say, but you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Listen, man, let me tell people where they could find you, and please support Corey Wong. He's awesome. If you haven't heard him play, go on YouTube, buy his stuff, and check him out. He's a really good player, really funky, really upbeat. You know, all the ska influences that you have come through. All the energy you're putting in is loud and clear. The vibe is awesome. It's just really good, you know, rock and roll to me. His new album coming out is called The Optimist, and if you go to his website right now, while it's fresh in your mind, before anything else comes up, go to CoreyJWong.com, CoreyJWong, WONG.com. And he's got a really cool thing going where you could pre-order his record, and you're also going to get free guitar lessons, which is probably worth five times the value of, you know, or 10 times the value that you'd have to pay for whatever he's charging you for the record, let alone to try to get him in person. So check that out. He also does tracks. He's always getting asked to play on people's records. You can contact him on his website. Again, that's Corey J. Wong. He is on social media. He's on Instagram and Facebook. I know it's going to sound crazy, but also under Corey J. Wong. And check out, he's going to be touring this summer with Wolfpack, and it's Vulfpeck. I'm going to say that again louder just because I love saying it. Wolfpack. They'll be touring in Europe. And then Corey's actually in Europe 3 weeks on his solo gig. So all my listeners that are in Europe, please support Corey. Go check him out. Tell him you heard about him first on this show, and he will sign your selfie.
I'll sign the front of your iPhone.
He'll sign the front of your iPhone. and it'll come out when you take the picture. He's got a special camera. What else? Did I miss anything, man? He gives, I don't know if I said, he does Skype lessons for, you know, people who are serious about it. Contact him again on his website. It's CoreyJWong.com. He's got a contact form. Anything else, man?
I think we covered it.
All right.
We covered a lot of ground today. We
covered a lot of ground today. Our assignment tomorrow is, I want you to memorize this interview. The first 150 minutes.
But what's the incentive?
Just because I don't think you can.
All right, there we go. That's enough right there. Yeah. Not even the A in the class. It's that you told me nobody could do it.
That's right. Hey, man, thank you very much for everything. I really appreciate it. This has been fun and good getting to know you. And everybody, go support Corey Wong. Thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed this interview as much as I did. Thanks to Corey again for spending all this time with us. I definitely appreciate it. Been very generous with your time and with yourself. Go to everyonelovesguitar.com. Sign up to get notified of future episodes along with some early product announcements and discounts. And you want to definitely get on our newsletter. And remember, this is important. Ties in with everything we talked about. Happiness is a choice. So choose wisely. Be nice.
Like,
there you go, brother. Be nice. Go play your guitar and have fun. Till next time, peace and love, everybody. I'm out. We hope you enjoyed this show. If you did, subscribe to the Everyone Loves Guitar podcast, and you can do this online at everyonelovesguitar.com or on iTunes. And if you like the show, please leave us a 5-star positive review. The more 5-star reviews we get, the higher our show ranks, and higher rankings mean we get to continue speaking with cool, interesting guests on our show. We'll see you on the next episode, and until then, keep playing your guitar and have fun making music.